Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1 begins, as you know, like this: in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And there we have this basic general statement of fact, which is to be received by faith. By faith, says the writer to the Hebrews in chapter 11 and verse 3. By faith we understand that the world was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was made out of things which do not appear. Ex nihilo, out of nothing. And so this very first verse of the whole Bible gives the lie to atheism. There is a God, in the beginning God. It gives the lie to pantheism, which is the belief that the earth is God, that things are God. Everything that exists is God. That God, in other words, is a captive to the creation. But the Bible says that God existed before there was any creation. He is separate from the creation. Even if this world were to go away, it would be destroyed, and every other planet and every star and everything. So there was nothing, there would still be God. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and he did so out of nothing. He spoke and it was there. Now, we know we'll have no real conflict with science in regard to verse 1. Because, of course, although there are many atheistic scientists who don't believe in any God, there are many who do believe in God. Science does not deny in any way the existence of God. And insofar as we speak of creation, scientific evidence that's come to light confirms creation. If we were to go through the different sciences, and I'm not going to take up time with this tonight, but if we were to go through the different sciences, I would be able to show you that it points back to a beginning. The world has not always been here. It started. There are energies in the world that are moving about, and various other things that we could point to, which show that the world has not always been the same. It's not an eternal world. It had a beginning. It points to creation. And so even in books that I've been picking up this week to check on what things have been said in children's encyclopedias and so on, they even speak about when the earth began. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So we have no problem there. But now we go on to verse 2. The earth was without form and void. Two Hebrew words that are often put together, they rhyme, tohu and bohu, and they mean shapeless, without form, without order, and void, or empty, nothing in it, a rather arid waste. And this was the condition of the world. They were without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. The word Spirit is the same in Hebrew as its word for breath and its word for wind. The wind of God, the breath of God, and the Spirit of God are interchangeable terms, but I think it's right to speak here of the Spirit. It puts the accent in the right place. Was moving over the face of the waters, or was brooding, as the original has it, as if like a hen hatching something out of an egg, moving over it to bring life out of it, to bring order out of it, to bring something out of nothing. And it seems that the picture that we have is that in the very first instance there was just stuff, just the raw material. And then God began to shape it and make it into the earth that we know. Like a potter who is going to make a lovely pot or a lovely image of some kind, he starts with just a piece of stuff, rather shapeless and formless, without form and void. And then he begins to shape it. And that seems to me to be the picture that we have here. Except that God does it by his word, as we shall see at a later date. But then we come to the story of creation. We've been looking really in the first two verses at who created the heaven and the earth and all things therein. Now the Bible is going on to say really something about hell. And insofar as we try to work it back from what are called the genealogies in chapter 5 and chapter 10 and chapter 11, that is to say the long list of who was the son of who and who was the son of who and who was the son of who and so on all the way back, we might say when, how and when. And that's where some of our difficulties arise. If we take chapter 1 of Genesis as a simple historical narrative, and that certainly seems to be the way that it is written when we first read it, we would conclude that the world was made, and all things in it, in 6 days. On the first day, verses 3 to 5, God made light to shine upon the earth. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And he separated night from dark, day from night, light from darkness. And then, after day 1, we would see that on day 2, verses 6 to 8, God made the atmosphere. That's what the word firmament means. That there was a lot of water about, apparently, the face of the deep. And that God separated the waters so that there was a canopy of water above the atmosphere and then water upon the earth and this sort of air or atmosphere in between. We realise that it means that atmosphere, when we look at, for instance, verses like verse 14, where he speaks about let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens, and it speaks about the sun and the moon. And when it speaks about the birds in verse 20, let birds fly above the earth across the firmament of the heavens. Well, of course, they fly in the air, in the atmosphere. And then on day 3, verses 9 to 13, we would see the dry land created. Once again, there's a separation of the waters. This time, a separation of the waters on the earth, so that there are oceans or seas and continents, dry land. Also on day 3, we read of the creation of vegetation. Plants yielding seed, fruit trees, and so on. That's also in those verses 9 to 13. And then on day 4, somewhat perhaps to our surprise, we read of the creation of the sun and the moon. Let there be lights in the firmament, verses 14 through to 19. And there was evening and morning, a fourth day. And then on day 5, we have the creation of fish and of birds. Verses 20 to 23, God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the firmament." Verse 21, so God created great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm. And then it goes on about birds as well. And then on day 6, we read in verses 24 to through to verse 31 that God created animals and man. And verses 24 and 25, the creation of animals, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds. And then in verse 26, there's a climax to God's creative work. Then God said, "Let us make man." And verses 26 to 31 deal primarily with the creation of man. Then on the seventh day, chapter 2 and verses 1 to 3, we read of God's rest. Well, now that would seem to speak of the how if we take this chapter as a simple historical narrative. When it comes to the question of when, I say we have to use these genealogies, or men have used the genealogies, that long list in chapter 5 and chapter 10 and 11, and worked it back. And the most famous person to give a date for this particular week of creation was the Archbishop of Armagh, who lived between 1581 and 1658, and whose name was James Usher. And Usher worked it back to the year 4004 BC. And this date found its way into many Bibles, and you may even have a Bible with this date at the top of the page, 4004 BC. Well, that was Usher who did that. It's not part of the inspired text, but it's his work to give us a date. Professor Lightfoot, who was a 17th century Cambridge Hebrew scholar, confirmed this date. Only he went a bit further, and he said that it was the week, the 18th to the 24th of October, and that Adam was created on the 23rd of October at 9 o'clock in the morning. Brewster, who didn't agree with this scholar, the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge, did not venture to commit himself. Well, there we are. Now, there's some difficulties, of course, with this. We have difficulties with regard to age, the age of the earth, with regard to this date, 4004 BC, and so on. And we have difficulties with regard to the sequence of the events which are recorded in Genesis 1, the order in which things were created or appear to have been. There are various sciences which are involved, in fact they're probably all involved, but primarily there's the science of geology, which is a study of the earth's crust, of the rocks. There's the science of historical biology, which is, biology is the study of living things, and historical biology, of course, is a study of things which have lived down the years and centuries. There's a study of paleontology, which is a study of fossils. People have split open rocks and found fossilized plants and animals and even men. And they've become like rock formations, stratified into rocks. And this study of fossils is called paleontology, and there's anthropology, which is a study of man, and so on. Now, all of these studies, when we read our science books, whether it be at school or our encyclopedias or whatever it is, seem to tell a very different story from what we read in Genesis chapter 1. For one thing, they say that the earth is very, very old indeed. Certainly a great deal older than 4004 BC. The vast majority seem to say that the earth was created about 5 billion years ago, that's when it began, 5 billion years ago. That primitive life started in the sea at about 1 to 2,000 million years ago. There are a lot of differences between the estimates, but they all say a long time ago. And then there came the reptiles, and then there came the birds and the mammals, and finally there came modern man, who is called Homo sapiens, and who lived and appeared upon the earth something like about 25,000 years ago. So, they tell us that compared with the date of the earth itself, man is very, very recent indeed. If you imagine Cleopatra's needle on the embankment of the Thames, that great big obelisk, they say that if that represents the age of the earth from when it was first in its gaseous or whatever state it was, if you put a penny on the top, that represents the time that there's been life upon the earth. And the time of man would be a thin postage stamp. And they say that they can prove all this from the fossil evidence in the rocks and the dating of the rocks in their various strata. They're like a cake in stratas, and they can date them and so on. So we have this account in Genesis, and we have this date suggested of 4004 BC, and even if these genealogies are not complete, and some have suggested that they don't necessarily go back to the next generation. They may leap over a few generations, like they talked of Jesus as the son of David. Well, that meant the descendant of David. So some have suggested that these genealogies may not be complete, and they may not give us a true time factor. But even if it stretched back considerably more, there's going to be quite a discrepancy, isn't there, between 5 billion years and 4004, and so we have problems. I may have cause to use the word evolution. I don't want to deal in any detail with the theory of evolution tonight. I will do that in the course of these sermons as we go through Genesis, particularly as we go through Genesis 1 and 2 with the creation of man. I don't want to do it tonight. But I think I ought to offer some kind of definition. If I speak of evolution, I mean by that the belief that there was progressive development from the simple to the complex. That means to say that all life started very, very simple, say one cell, and that there has been, over millions of years, progressive development from the simple to the complex, and it is still going on. Now, that is what is meant by evolution. Now, there are some people who believe in change within the species. Well, all right, so do I. There's evidence for that, very good evidence for that. That's almost, you could say, a fact. But evolution is a kind of theory or doctrine which goes far beyond that. Now, the majority of evolutionists are atheistic. They believe this just happened, and it happened by itself. We're not concerned with them. I'm concerned with those who believe in God. But there are those who are theistic evolutionists. That means they believe that God was back of it all and in it all and providing the power for it all, but that this was how he brought everything into being, through this long process of evolving complexity of life. Now, as to whether there's any truth in that, whether that can be sustained, we'll consider sooner or later. I just want to say that I feel I must deal with these things for these reasons, because this age of the earth and this age of reptiles going back millions of years, and even man, and all this story and this evolution is taught in school almost without exception, and it's taught as if it were fact. And you can pick up almost any children's book today, go into Bentalls or any of the big stores and pick up a children's book, how the world began, how life began, where you came from, and you will find that this is stated as a fact. Well, billions of years ago, there was this gas and there was these elements and so on and so forth. And I'll say more about that next week. But we have many young people in our congregation tonight, and you know, as I know, that if you've done any of these things at school at all, from the infant stage, you have been told over and over and over again that man began all these years ago, and then gradually this happened through this evolutionary process. And therefore the young Christian reading Genesis 1 has certainly got problems. And I want to help you to try and sort out some of these problems a little bit. Tonight, I'm going to offer to you some of the suggestions that have been made by Bible-believing Christians to reconcile the findings and doctrines of science with the Bible. And then next week, if the Lord wills, we shall consider a solution to the problem. But we won't get to that tonight. And then we'll go on, having cleared the rubble from the pathway, we'll then go on to expound through Genesis 1 and see some of the lessons that God has to teach us through it. But you can't journey down this byway until you've cleared some of the rubble out of the way. Well now, what have people said to try and answer the problem of science and Genesis 1? For those of us who believe the Bible, we know this. We know that on the one hand, the Bible is true because it's God's book. He's the author of it. We know, on the other hand, that true science is true because God's the author of that as well. And so we ought to be able to come to the truth and reconcile the two together. Well, now, the argument which is put forward and has been put forward is this. If there seems to be a conflict between what science is saying and what the Bible is saying, either we have misinterpreted science or we have misinterpreted the Bible. And many evangelical Christians have said, well, there does seem to be this absolute unanimity amongst scientists and all the different sciences about the age of the earth and the fossils in the rocks and all this sort of different stratas, not necessarily evolution, but at any rate this age laid down all these billions of years. So maybe we have misunderstood the Bible, misunderstood Genesis 1. We need to reinterpret it. We need to look at it again and see if we can find where we've gone wrong in taking it as a simple historical account of how God made the world and everything in it. Now I'm going to suggest to you four theories that have been put forward, and the first of them is called the gap theory. Now the gap theory says this, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth refers to a prior creation. A creation of the earth in which there was perfection and beauty and creatures that were living, Satan, angelic beings living and placed upon the earth. And then there came judgment because there came sin into this community. And God judged this community and cast them out. And that's why in verse 2, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. That refers to a judged earth, of which we know practically nothing. And that there is a gap, in other words, between verse 1 and verse 2, or if you prefer it, verse 2 and verse 3, when God began to reconstruct the earth. And they say that the word was in verse 2 should be translated became. But in Hebrew there was no word became, so the writer, Moses, had to use the word was, but it should be the word became. The earth became without form and void. Now they say that's confirmed in Isaiah 45 and verse 18. Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 18. For thus saith the Lord, who created the heavens, he is God, who formed the earth and made it, he established it. He did not create it a chaos. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord and there is no other. He did not create the chaos. He formed it to be inhabited. Now this view is put forward as an answer to the problem. Now, says the person who accepts the gap theory, all of your rocks, all of your fossils, all these things, these long geological ages, they were in the first creation. They're in Genesis 1:1. And then God began to remake the earth. And that's what he's concerned to tell us about. And he did that in a week, very likely 4,004 years ago. Now, this view has become very widespread and popular amongst evangelicals. About in the beginning of the 19th century, it was put forward by Dr. Thomas Chalmers. And then a very great man, A.H. Pember, at the end of the century, 1876, wrote a book, Earth's Earliest Ages, and kind of canonized this view. And then Dr. Schofield, in his famous Schofield Bible, fossilized it forever by putting it into his Bible. And so Christians for many years have read this, and they've felt that that answers all the problems. I have two books here, for instance, of Genesis and Evolution by Dr. DeHaan. Some of you may have heard Dr. DeHaan before he died on the radio. Back to the Bible broadcast, I think it was, or something like this. Well, now he says quite categorically, the second verse records the earth as it was after something had happened to plunge the earth into darkness and make it waste and void. Now there is only one thing that could bring the earth under the curse, and that one thing is sin. So somewhere in the period between the first and second verses of Genesis, sin entered with its resultant curse and the description found in verse 2. And he goes on to speak of it. There is every scientific evidence of a prehistoric creation on the earth. Geological examinations of the earth's surface reveal that in the dim, distant past there flourished on this earth a vegetation of unusual luxuriance and prehistoric animals of gigantic size. We find fossils of these animals which lived millions of years ago. And he goes on to say, all comes in this verse 1. In Genesis 1:1 we have the creation as it came from the hand of God, perfect and abounding in a beautiful and gorgeous as well as gigantic creation of animals and vegetation. And then he says, how long it was like that, we don't know. But then sin entered in and God judged the air. And that's the answer to the problem. And then Arthur Pink, A.W. Pink, whose writings are very, very helpful, he says exactly the same thing, very straightforwardly, when he says, we cannot but believe that these creations were worthy of himself and that they reflected the perfections of their maker, that they were exceedingly fair in their pristine beauty. Certainly the earth on the morning of its creation must have been vastly different from its chaotic state as described in Genesis 1:2. And the earth was without form and void, and must refer to a condition of the earth much later than what is before us in the preceding verse. It is now over 100 years ago since Dr. Chalmers called attention to the fact that the word was, in Genesis 1:2, should be translated became, and that between the first two verses of Genesis 1, some terrible catastrophe must have happened. That this catastrophe may have been connected with the apostasy of Satan seems more than likely. And then he says that that some catastrophe did occur is certain from Isaiah 45:18, which expressly declares that the earth was not created in the condition in which Genesis 1:2 views it. All right then. There are some difficulties, however, with taking that view, and briefly they are these. First of all, Isaiah 45:18 may simply mean that God did not create the world formless and empty and chaotic. He was going to do more than that. He was going to make it into something beautiful and ready to be inhabited and fill it with people. And so it isn't as conclusive as some have made out that verse. Creation wasn't really finished until the end of the sixth day, when God saw all and it was very good. Secondly, on this question of whether it should be translated was or became, from my reading, very few scholars will give any credence whatsoever to the translation became. Quoting from one book, he says, a student writing a master's thesis polled 20 leading scholars in the United States, asking them if there were any exegetical evidences for a gap interpretation of Genesis 1:2, and they unanimously replied in the negative. And what that complicated sentence means is they all said, no, it should be translated was, not became. And then thirdly, one reading Genesis chapter 1, I don't know what you feel, but one reading Genesis 1 does not have the impression that this is creation over again the second time. You see, what these people are really saying is that God did it all once, and then it all fell and was judged and was in this condition, and then God started and did it all again. And that what we're reading is creation Mark 2 in Genesis chapter 1. It doesn't seem to read like that. You don't have that sort of feeling as you read it. And then in the fourth place, this theory is really to try and help us to take geology into our biblical system. But geologists won't own it, because they would say there's no evidence for this at all, unless you're prepared to accept pre-Adamite men. In other words, they would say that in this first creation, whatever it was, there are evidences of men as well, because man goes back, they say, many, many thousands and thousands of years. Furthermore, they would say nowadays that there is no evidence for a great chaotic period intervening in the rock evidence down the years. It seems to go on without this great break, and so on. F.F. Bruce, some time ago, wrote in a magazine seeking to show that became is not a possible translation. A second view which has been put forward to try and marry science and scripture is the long day theory, or the day age theory. What does that say? Well, that says that the word day in the Old Testament doesn't always mean 24 hours. Sometimes it means a long period of time. It's in the Hebrew the word yom, Y-O-M. It occurs many, many times in the Old Testament, and for instance in Psalm 50 verse 1 you have in the day of trouble, speaking generally of a day, you see, the day of trouble, a long period of time or a period of trouble. And then of course you have that famous verse in the New Testament, 2 Peter 3:8, one day is with the Lord with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. And so they say, these days may not be 24-hour days, but long geological periods of time. Any length you like, any length that's necessary. But it's just put in this form. Also, the long day people say that it's remarkable how there's a similarity in the order of the fossils that the scientists tell us they can find, and the order which seems to be there in the Bible. Plants and marine life, and animals, and man. But there are some difficulties with this series, aren't there? The difficulties are that Genesis chapter 3, which is the story of the fall of man, and the curse and judgment of God upon the world and upon man because of his sin, would seem to indicate that death and disease and decay came into the world because of man's sin and because of the fall. And that when God made the world, it was made perfect without these things. But you see, this would have to allow for decay and disease and death over millions of years of part of God's creation before the fall, before the curse, before sin had come into the world. And the same criticism could be applied to the gap theory as well, because it does the same thing. When we read through this chapter, 6 times we read that God saw that it was good. And at the end, in verse 31, we read that God saw all that he had made, that it was very good. Now, are we to assume that what God called very good included what we know as nature red in tooth and claw, with disease and with death and with decay and with cruelty and suffering and so on? If that is so, what are we to make of the curse in Genesis 3? Take Genesis 3, verse 17. To Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you shall not eat, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return. But the geologists would say, but that's been going on for millions and millions of years. And it makes a difficulty. There are other places which speak of a cursed world because of the fall, groaning until the day of restoration. In any case, the animals, according to Genesis 1, would appear to have been herbivorous. That means that they didn't eat meat, they ate plants. Verse 13, Genesis 1, to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, to every thing that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And there are many people who believe that the preying animals, one upon another, came about because of the fall and the judgment of God upon the world because of man's sin as the representative of all creation. Well, we'll go into that more when we come to it in chapter 3. And then in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 11, it does seem to speak of these days as 24-hour days. Exodus 20:11, where it speaks about us taking the Sabbath day and keeping it holy. 4, verse 11 of Exodus 20, in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. It doesn't seem to suggest long millions of years, but a week. And that's why man must have a week period for his work schedule, with one day's rest. The same occurs again in Exodus further on, chapter 31 and verse 17. It is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. And there again, it's in a context regarding the Sabbath. So there's the expression in chapter 1, and the evening and the morning. There was evening and there was morning. One day there was evening and there was morning a second day. evening and morning seems to suggest, again, 24 hours, a day as we know it. Even if one were to ignore all these difficulties and accept the long day theory, the day-age theory, it still wouldn't solve the problem, the geological and biological problems, because there would be a vegetation epoch, day three, long day three, before the insects of day six, no, day five. But that is day six, isn't it? Creeping things. But from what I know of what they tell us, insects and vegetation kind of go together, tie up together in a kind of cycle. We've got the birds created in day five before the insects, reptiles and mammals in day six. And remember, in this theory, we're thinking not of days, but of long periods of geological time. And most difficult of all is the fact that we have the sun and moon not created till day four. One would have to think of another theory to try to explain that. Quoting 2 Peter 3, 8, one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, 1,000 years one day is not all that helpful either, unless you literalize it and postulate 6 periods of 1,000 years each. But that isn't enough. The geologists want millions of years, not thousands of years, not 6,000 years. Man himself, they say, even modern man, Homo sapiens, is 25,000 years old. It seems when you try to marry them up with this theory, you almost end up with as many problems as you have to start with. A third theory which has been put forward is the six revelations theory, I think is the only word I can think for it. It was put forward by a man called P.J. Wiseman in a book called Creation Revealed in 6 days. His theory was that it doesn't mean that God created the world in 6 days of 24 hours, but that Moses had it revealed to him as to the order and the way in which God had created, and it was like this, that Moses kind of was in a sleep or something, and then he saw this picture of what God was doing, and then it was dark, and that was day one. And then it was light again, and he saw another picture, and then it was like a sort of slideshow, and then it was dark again, and then it was dark, was day two, and so on. I'm not going to spend any time criticising that because it hasn't found very wide acceptance among scholars. The fourth theory, and one that is quite popular amongst evangelicals today, is what you might call the parable or poetry theory. And that is that the Bible is not a textbook of science. We're not to treat Genesis 1 as if it were a science textbook. The Bible is not a science textbook, they tell us. If it had been written in scientific terms, nobody would have been able to understand it until the 20th century. And even then, only those trained in science would be able to understand it. It's written in poetic language, simple parabolic language, that the truth comes in poetry and is not to be intended to be a scientific account of how God created the world. This, you will find, is the view taken by J.A. Thomson in the New Bible Dictionary, published by the IVS, and seems to be favoured by many others. The difficulties that I have with this view are these. First of all, it seems to me to read like history. We have a lot of poetry in the Bible, we know that. There's poetry in the Psalms. There's poetry in the Psalms about the creation, when I see the work of thy fingers which thou hast made. And it's obvious it's poetry. We know it's poetry. It reads like poetry. But Genesis chapter 1 seems to read like history. God said this, and God made that, and then when he'd done that, it was the end of that day. And then he did this. It seems to read like a historical account, as far as I can see. And it's interesting to me that the RSV, that prints poetry as poetry, doesn't print Genesis 1 as poetry. And then Exodus chapter 20 and verse 11, and chapter 31 and verse 17 that we've just looked at, that says you rest on the seventh day because God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh day, doesn't give any hint that it wasn't history and literal and fact, but that it was really poetry and parable and isn't to be read as history. It seems to be basing the very Sabbath day upon the fact that it was history. And then I think we must be very careful when we say the Bible isn't a textbook of science, isn't a book of science. It's true. the Bible is not a scientific textbook. Its primary object is to teach us about God. But the Bible is true. The Bible is God's word. The Bible is God's words. God breathed out all these words. He breathed out Genesis 1. And we must be very careful what we're saying. Whatever God says, whatever branch of literature or the arts or whatever it is he's speaking in, it's true. If he makes a historical statement, it's true. If he makes a scientific statement, it's true. Are we having suggested to us that the one who made the stars didn't really know much about astronomy? That the one who made the rocks didn't really understand about geology? But the great God who made every living thing didn't really know much about biology? But the one who put the fossils there and saw them as they were formed and knew and knows every single fossil, though they run into millions, needs to learn something about paleontology. No, my friends, if God makes a scientific statement, it's a true statement. And therefore I don't feel that any of these theories really solve the problem for us. And they create as many problems as they solve. But I'm afraid it's going to be a little bit like Mrs. Dale's diary, and I'm going to have to say to you that next week we will come back to this problem and say, well then, if we've looked at Scripture and tried to reinterpret Scripture to make it all tie up, and we can't do it, maybe we should look at science. And see if, in fact, in spite of all the many who've been telling us and how many books they've written and so on, maybe there's something faulty with their reasoning. And maybe it's just as it's written, after all. But you know, I don't want to end tonight with that. Because we've been talking about how. And as I said at the beginning, I feel we have to talk about how. Not because it's the most important thing, but because it looms so large in a young person's education today. But it's a very small and insignificant question compared to the question who and why. How God made the world, whether it was millions of years or 6 days, when he made the world, is interesting. But it isn't vital. But who made the world, the fact that he did, and why he made the world is very vital for you to find out and for me to find out. Let's illustrate it like this. Supposing somebody had made an atomic bomb. Now you might go to them and say, how did you make this atomic bomb? How does it work? How is it made? I once asked a physicist, a friend of mine, a doctor of physics, how atomic energy worked. And he said, well, putting it very simply, and about an hour later I was glad he didn't put it very complicatedly, but you may feel, well, this is very interesting, I want to go into this, how did this bomb, well, how does it work? But what's a far more vital concern to you is, who's made the bomb and what's he going to do with it? Why has he made it? Who and why? Not how. And I believe it's just the same with creation, with everything that God has made. Of course it's of interest to us how he did it. It's not wrong for that to be of interest to us. We're meant to be scientific. We're meant to study the creation and analyse it and measure it and weigh it and all the rest of it. Nothing wrong with doing that. But the most important question is not how did he make the world, but did he make it? And if so, why did he make it? The most important question for you is, did God make you? And if so, why? And I want to ask you tonight, do you know the answer to that question? I tell you on the authority of the Bible, God did make you. You're not an accident. You didn't come by accident. You didn't come by sheer chance. You were put here. And there's a God back of it all. And there's a God overlooking us all tonight. And he looks down into this church and he sees you and he sees me and he sees more than anyone else can see. He sees right down deep inside of us. He knows the very thoughts we think. He knows the disappointments we have. He knows the sins we commit. He knows the things we say and the things we fail to say. He knows all about us through and through, better than we know ourselves. He made us. Why did he make us? He made us, as the Bible, that we might live to glorify him and please him. Made in the image of God, to be his friend. But you know what we've done? We've turned away from him. We've said we don't want to be your friend. We're going to live as if you didn't exist. We're going to pretend that you didn't make us. We just happened. We just came by chance. We're going to ignore you. We're going to live selfishly just for ourselves. And we're going to indulge in sin and not care a jiff about it. That's what we said. And we could rightly expect that this God who put us here and who sees all this could say, all right, then I'll judge you. But this God is a God of love. And this God has said, but I love you. And I want to save you and rescue you and turn you and change you and make you clean again and whole again. And I want you to make you again like I really wanted you to be. And I'll do it by my Spirit. And he so loved you and he so loved me that he sent forth his Son. And that's what all the Bible is about.